The Sky News Centre at 5. An Islamic State supporter has been jailed for a minimum of 24 years for murdering an imam in Rochdale. 21-year-old Mohammed Saeedi acted as the getaway driver in February. Nick Qureshi reports.
There's no hope left for me because every time it rains heavily and I just don't know what to do. I really think that I must fly and leave this house. I love this house. I don't want to leave it, but the problem is...
A judge has ruled a British man with Asperger's should be extradited to the US on computer hacking charges. Larry Love could face up to 99 years in prison if he's found guilty of hacking into American agencies. He's been granted leave to appeal against the ruling and says he's relieved.
I really worry for the toll it's taking on my health and my family's because of the stress. It just means that when we do win, it will have more force and set a stronger precedent. So it's all grist to the mill.
The mother of Ben Needham, who disappeared on COS as a toddler 25 years ago, says she's been told to fear the worst. It appears British investigators now believe he may have been crushed to death by a digger. Two people have been hurt after a train derailed near Watford Junction, causing major disruption to services. The 619 from Milton Keynes to Euston hit a landslide during torrential rain. Diane James has been elected the new leader of UKIP. The deputy chairman was the front runner in the contest to replace Nigel Farage. She won with more than 8,000 votes. That's the latest. I'm Kieran Corr.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. One of the Queen's representatives in the city, former Deputy Lord Lieutenant, or possibly Lord Lieutenant, he's going in an interview soon, David John. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, how was the global climate panel chosen and can we trust them? At the present rate, how many years until the polar ice caps disappear completely? And why are some scientists saying a nuclear war and a nuclear winter that followed it would be good because it would stop global warming? Are there any scientists who are being straight with us rather than in the pocket of one interest group or another? And why are these basic questions about climate change not even asked, let alone answered? Plus, Hillary Clinton's health. Is it really pneumonia? Her coughing fits have been happening all year. And why isn't Bernie Sanders being suggested to take over from her if she drops out of the US presidential race? Also, taking no chances, how Israel stole the atomic bomb from the United States. And they had them in place by 1966, an entire year before the Six-Day War, where the IDF kicked Egyptian, Syrian and Jordanian forces out of East Jerusalem and stole the occupied territories from the Palestinians, the so-called buffer zone. Plus China's territorial dispute with the US-backed Philippines, where their president Duterte this week is accused of running death squads in his own country, as well as himself actually murdering his opponents. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight's lows are 14 Celsius and dry this weekend. Highs around 21 Celsius with sunny spells tomorrow and Sunday. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius. Temperatures up again. Plenty of sunshine this week, but also some heavy showers. Next weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of September, highs around again 21 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is one of the Queen's representatives in the city, Deputy Lord Lieutenant of Bristol, David John. Hi, David. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony, and good afternoon, listeners.
Now, what about a Lord Lieutenant? What is a Lord Lieutenant and what is a Deputy Lord Lieutenant?
Deputy is the deputy to the Lord Lieutenant. The Lord Lieutenant is an appointment made by the Queen, and I think most of the counties have one, and they're to give out awards, mediate between any disputes between charities, and in Bristol's case, between the two universities. It's really to meet and greet any members of the royal family that come to the county and city of Bristol as well.
How did you get that job then?
Sounds one like does quite a not nice apply, job. One is asked.
So how, I mean, what context were you tapped up for this?
I was sitting next to the Lord Lieutenant at a dinner, and we were talking about a business he had a stake in.
So what dinner? What sort of event was that?
I'd rather not say, actually.
Really? And, really? A secret dinner?
It was the... Oh, I've got to... wangled it out of me. It was the Merchant Venturers.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yep. Much to my embarrassment. Anyway, now the world knows. And when he phoned up and asked me, I thought, well, yeah, that's a good idea. Support somebody who's supporting St. Paul's. And after I accepted, I asked him how his business was going. He said, oh, I've sold that. So I was hoist by my own petard.
Okay, so what context politically, you know, how have you been involved in the city in the past?
Well, I came in 30 years ago, so it was 87. And
from London?
From North London, yep. And I became councillor after Ted Fowler of Ashley, and that was for two terms. This was on Avon County Council, and my term ended when Avon was abolished. During the course of that, 9 years, I served as the chairman of the council for 1 year.
Labour Party, I'm imagining? From
definitely,
Ashley Ward.
Definitely.
Why Labour Party, and did you stay?
Well, I've always been a member of the Labour Party until Kinnock came to the leadership, and following him, Blair and then Brown, never changed my ideals about the Labour Party must be more than just trying to manage the economy and satisfy the business and the middle class community that they were good with the economy. It must be for something that would change the way Britain was business in Britain was being conducted and how people were being treated. And I'm glad to say that Jeremy Corbyn now fits that bill, and I will be rejoining the Labour Party come September the 25th when he's re-elected to
You sound
leadership.
Pretty confident that he's going to win and Owen Smith is going to lose.
I think it's backed by my own soundings between of people, and also the overwhelming support of those who are allowed to vote before the 25th of January, members who are allowed to vote between the 24th and 5th of January this year. I can see no great swing against Jeremy. I can see the media against him, but I can't see any swing about the membership against him.
Well, just take us back to your days on the council. Do you say you were leading the council at that time? What year are we talking about?
1990 to 1991, I was chairman of the council. It was a hung council, but Labour was the majority party. And the thing about a hung council is that you, your votes are necessary and counted, and you have to be there, otherwise the other two parties band together and defeat the majority party.
I mean, did you manage to achieve much in that time? Because it must have been quite awkward.
Yeah, it was the days of Thatcher, so it was a matter of stopping the cuts, ameliorating the cuts, making sure that any workers who had to leave did so on a voluntary basis and not compulsory.
Well, I mean, we've had this since George Ferguson. I nearly called him Lord Ferguson then. George Ferguson was mayor, and also now with Marvin. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot that they can do to stop these cuts from Westminster. Do you think you had any more luck back in the early 90s?
We had less, because less of the revenue was determined by the county and raised by the county. A lot of the revenue was already spoken for in terms of staff salary, so there was very little leeway in which to make savings and to which to change things. I've got to say that it's not good enough for council services to be treading water. Workers need to see what the future is, both in terms of their own career progression and also in terms of the service they're investing their time in. Just to keep saying, well, let's have the challenge, as it was called, of doing the same thing with less money is not good enough. Workers need to have an incentive, not monetary incentive, but in terms of their prospective...
Well, I mean, there are some loud voices around the city, not least of which are the merchant venturers and people around them, the Conservatives, for example, who are often talking about, and we have them on this show, that the city council should be run more as a business and less as some sort of old-fashioned Marxist-style public service.
Well, the business model isn't too great at the moment. I mean, we have Liam Fox calling the top business people fat and lazy, so we don't want services run along those models. We don't want our directors to be on the golf course or whatever. There are sometimes advantages to looking to competition, but outsourcing isn't the answer either.
But the directors will say, we're on the golf course, we're doing deals there.
Yeah, but sometimes they're dodgy deals, so we don't really want to go into that.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let's just bring you in on this whole business of the cuts and what can be done by local authorities. What do you think in order to ameliorate the effects of them?
Well, it's very limited, isn't it? I mean, we've had all this fuss about whether we were going to have a mayor in Bristol, and a very small majority of a very small turnout decided we were going to have one, and there's all this fuss about who it's going to be, and Marvin's finally on second attempt become the mayor. But when all's said and done, the policies have been determined by central government effectively, and I'd rather have a Labour mayor than not. But at the same time, the fact of the matter is many people who voted Labour will have voted Labour with no illusions. What we've got to do is change the national policy, and that's one of the things that Ferguson didn't realise. There's not much point being mayor of Bristol. There isn't much point to it, and of course that's all he ever wanted to be, and all his aspiration ever was. And at the end of the day, he didn't have any power to do anything any more than Marvin does.
We've also got to realise that Bristol isn't the be-all and end-all of the world. We don't want all the infrastructure to stop at Bristol and not being able to get to Taunton, Exeter, Devon, Cornwall. You know, yeah. We are part of the South West, and we've got to play a role, and we've got to recognise that we are in the
South
West.
Are you for the city region and the Metro Mayor? That's what you seem to be saying here.
No. The Metro Mayor would be another layer of bureaucracy, another layer of administration, another cost to be borne. I think what we mustn't do is to just say that we're just about Bristol and we only want to know about Bristol and we want to make Bristol a thriving economy. We must look to the much wider community in terms of geography.
Tell us a bit more about this role as Lord Lieutenant. Have you actually been to some sort of ceremony to make you Deputy Lord Lieutenant? And I know you said that you're going to be, you're in the running to be the Lord Lieutenant themselves. Maybe they're stepping down or something.
There wasn't a ceremony. It was granting of a certificate, and there's something called the London Gazette where your name is published along with debtors and insolvencies. I think mine was quite near the back. The Deputy Lord Lieutenant appointment, from what I can remember. So you had to wade through quite a bit of impecunery to get to it.
I mean, what do you make of the power, if any, of the monarchy nowadays? Because most of us think, well, they're very wealthy, but not necessarily powerful. Because even appointments like the Lord Lieutenants are made by the Queen, but apparently the Prime Minister is the person that recommends to the Queen who she should appoint.
There's a committee, and I don't know where the committee's recommendations go, but in terms of the Lord of the monarchy, it seems to be more about the tourist attraction. I read that a couple of weeks ago that the money raised from visits to the royal estates, Buckingham Palace, Windsor Castle, etc., was larger than it's ever been, and certainly with the push for tourism to increase in London, then that's set to increase. We've also seen that the Duchy of Cornwall's income has risen to over £1 billion.
That's Prince Charles.
So it's all those inputs.
I'm going to ask you a question I'm sure you'd rather I didn't, which is, should the taxpayer be paying anything for the royal family, since they've got massive amounts of land, they've got enormous incomes of their own, personal incomes?
I can't remember the figures offhand. Something like 42 or 52 million pounds,
right,
is a civil list. But you've got to look at that investment as opposed to the, I think it's 200 million that was gained from visiting the Royal Estates.
But I think some people would say that this is just welfare for the super rich. I mean, why pay people who are already massive landowners? They're getting rents in every year, incredible income, much more than any of us could ever wish for.
Well, we've had the same argument about the reparations on slavery. You had the plantation owners who were compensated for freeing slaves, and that was wrong. In much the same way, the arguments about paying for a monarchy and paying for people to be supported when they are able to support themselves.
Well, look, we touched briefly on the Labour leadership contest. Labour Party will announce the result of the leadership contest at a special event on Saturday, September the 25th, that Saturday week or tomorrow week. The election result will come out the day before the start of the Labour Party annual conference in Liverpool. Well, we've had David's prediction. Martin, what's yours?
I think Corbyn is going to be re-elected with a larger majority than he had last time.
And that was around about 60%, I think, wasn't it, of the Labour Party membership, 59 or so?
Yeah. I think it's going to be even more decisive this time, actually. Mm.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. And it's almost like the last shots are being fired from the Owen Smith camp. And last night on the BBC Question Time, there was Alistair Campbell on there, who is, I believe, Martin, actually considered by some to be part of the coup attempt against Jeremy Corbyn. And he was there on the panel.
Yeah, well, I think he's connected with Portland Communications, which is the PR firm which has orchestrated most of the attempt to unseat Corbyn. So that's what, you know, they didn't want an election. They just wanted him to stand down. And, you know, they've tried everything, really. And the election's the last throw of the dice for
them. I mean, it's a fairly strong word to use, coup, isn't it? I mean, do you think that's fair?
I think it is fair, because the attempt has been made outside the party rules. I mean, Kerry McCarthy was saying, well, we don't need to have an election. Tom Watson can take over for now, and we'll just take it from there. But that's actually complete defiance of the rule book. So that they've tried to do it outside the rule book, and they've been dragged to forced back into playing by the rule book. But they didn't want to play by the rule book. They wanted to rip the rule book up.
I mean, I'm always a little bit staggered to see Alistair Campbell put by the BBC, who we pay for, up on the TV as some kind of serious commentator, particularly with his involvement with the run-up to the Iraq war. Number one, he was the person who, and this is well known and documented now, in fact Andrew Gilligan, who was very much involved in all that, wrote about it in the 10 years in 2013 after, in the Daily Telegraph, how Campbell had actually been the one who'd suggested the changes in the dossier which was going to be presented to the cabinet and others, insiders, to present the case for an invasion of Iraq. And it was Campbell that suggested those changes, and John Scarlett, MI6, who finally agreed to them. So, I mean, basically the dodgy dossier is Alistair Campbell's work. The other thing he did was he leaked the name to the public, to the press, not to the public, to the press, the day before Dr. David Kelly so sadly committed suicide, the government scientist, as he'd been outed. So Campbell is the sort of person that I would have much rather see, you know, possibly facing criminal charges rather than being presented to the public as the sort of person that can tell us about how our future should be. But anyway, let's have a listen now to some clips from, or a clip from, last night's BBC Question Time. You'll hear first of all from Tory MP Anna Soubry talking right at the very start about her opinion on John McDonnell, who is the Shadow Chancellor, a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. David, you could just give us your brief opinion of what you think of John McDonnell's policy, you know, as a opposition Chancellor.
Well, he's started off badly by agreeing to the Tory spending levels, and then he had to, when George Osborne backed down from that, then John McDonnell had to also compromise his positions. But once again, the Labour Party was trying to sell to the press and to the business that we can manage the economy just as good as the Tories. But that's not the point. The people who manage the economy are the financiers and the big multinational corporations.
Not our politicians, so well. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Anna Soubry talking about John McDonnell and then his reply from Question Time last night.
You're a very nasty piece of work, and I shall tell you this as well. Okay. I'll tell you this. Let me tell you what's happening.
If I can finish a sentence.
Can I tell you what's happening in Parliament? Obviously, I don't agree with Labour MPs, but there are a number of Labour MPs who are good and honourable, decent people, who believe in things that I don't agree with, but they add value and they are elected. They haven't formed a government, but they're there to do a job. And the job they're there to do is to hold my government to account and to represent those of you who are not Conservatives and make sure that your voice is heard and democracy prevails. And many of these people are frightened, so frightened, humiliated, almost terrorised by Mr. McDonnell and his gang, they will leave politics, and that's bad for politics.
Rubbish.
And there is a fine example of it, ladies and gentlemen. You are being let down. As a democracy, we need good, strong oppositions who are credible, who test government, hold them to account.
And so, what is your...
We're in the position of relying on the SNP to do the job of the opposition.
John McDonnell,
it's shameful.
All right. You
said he was a very nasty piece of work.
I think he is.
You may think that. You need to justify it if you say
because
that.
Because there are colleagues of mine in the House of Commons, Labour MPs, who are at the point of being terrorised by McDonnell and his cronies. And they don't stand up to them. There are women MPs who suffer day in and day out from misogynist, unpleasant, sexist abuse on Twitter, on Facebook, from people who apparently are within their own party. There is a Jewish Labour MP, a woman who is living in a safe house because of the levels of anti-Semitism she has to bear. It's a disgrace, and it must stop, and you, sir, can stop it.
This is Alistair Campbell.
Alistair Campbell,
do you recognise that picture? Just
let
before
me
I come
respond.
To John. I will let you.
You've not allowed me to speak while this abuse has been leveled at me. Let me make this absolutely clear, and we've made it clear time and time again. We will not tolerate abuse within the Labour Party. We've condemned it time and time again. Every time there's been a level of abuse that's been waged, and Jeremy Corbyn has made it absolutely clear, if we've identified the individual, they will be out of this party and suspended. Simple as that. We're not accepting this smear campaign that's going on from the Tories and others as well. We've been working over the last year to unite the party, and we were winning electorally and in the polls. Yes, a coup was launched by a small minority who could not accept Jeremy's mandate. We are a small minority who could not accept the mandate. Jeremy was elected on the basis of 59.5% of our members. We are now going through a democratic election. Once that election is over, whoever is the leader, we will unite behind. And we have been an effective opposition in terms of defeating the Tories on tax credits, on PIP, the cuts for disabled people, and a range of others.
Right. What were you saying in the background?
Well, isn't it interesting that the Tories feel that they have such a vested interest in the Labour Party's, who the Labour Party is going to choose as their leader? And they're echoing all of this stuff about anti-Semitism and women MPs hiding in their houses. It's very similar to what was claimed about Bernie Sanders supporters in the United States. Exactly the same kind of things were being said about them. Well, they couldn't really stick the anti-Semitism thing on him because he's Jewish. Incidentally, of course, there's one of the funders of the Labour Party whose name I've forgotten now. It'll pop into my. He's a Jewish supporter of the Labour Party. He actually took us to court to try and overturn Jeremy's.
Michael Foster,
that's right. But he is under suspension because he's accused the left wing of the Labour Party of being Sturmabteilung, that is to say, stormtroopers, Nazis. I don't mind people calling me a Nazi. If they want to call me a Nazi, they can call me whatever I like. But I do object to them saying that when I call them manipulators and traitors that I'm perfectly within my rights to do so. But if we're going to have freedom of speech and people can say whatever they like, then let's have everybody say whatever they like, and let's not have any crying for mummies. But on the other hand, in factual fact, it's the right wing of the party that have Anna Soubry there is not even a member of the party, who's coming out with all of this extremely, you know, is it really okay to call somebody a nasty piece of work? I suppose it is, Anna. You're a nasty piece of work.
David, what do you make of this bit of a bun fight on BBC Question Time last night? Accused John McDonnell accused of being a nasty piece of work and basically running a gang in the House of Commons as part of the Her Majesty's opposition.
Well, I mean, it's his party in terms of he was elected as the leader, and if the membership don't like the way he's leading it, then they will vote on up until the 24th of September. But for somebody who's not a member of the party to suddenly, to continually try to undermine the voters in another party is quite ridiculous. Can I just say that I had the privilege of working for Dawn Primorolo when she was leading the opposition to the Social Security Act, and she made a comment at question time. She asked a question of Margaret Thatcher, and she made the comment that if we don't all have a wealthy husband so we can get through the process and become an MP. Now, the press hounded Dawn Primorolo to much the effect that her son, who was just 11 at the time, had to climb over the back garden wall to get away from the hordes of press at the front door. So this is something that the Tories do all the time. They don't band together just to protect Labour MPs. They're quite able to and willing to attack Labour MPs themselves.
Also, there's been a lot of questions over the BBC this week. A couple of bits of news. One is the renewal of the charter, where some people are saying that it could become a subscription service. But also, maybe more importantly, we've had the announcement of the standing down of Rona Fairhead, who's the chairman of the BBC Trust. Now, she's someone who we've talked about a few times on this programme, and she's basically been told that it's Theresa May has decided that she doesn't really like David Cameron's choice to chair the BBC Trust. What do you make of the of all this, Martin? We've now got, apparently, we may even be seeing the BBC become a kind of subscription service. We're not talking about that happening straight away. What they're saying is this charter renewal, this particular one, is going to mean that in the future it may become a subscription service.
Well, I mean, the undermining of the BBC by Tory governments is been going on forever, hasn't it? And of course, what eventually happens is that the BBC, because they're constantly having their testicles squeezed, as it were, by the government, saying, well, you know, well, we don't know whether we're going to renew your charter and what have you, is that their political coverage becomes basically obsequious. So you've had, BBC's political editor, Robinson, and Kirstenberger, basically Tories, and, make no bones about it. And that, yet at the same time, the Tories hate the BBC because it's relatively impartial compared to the slavering popular press, which is basically just run by millionaires for millionaires. And the getting genuine independent information is actually quite tricky unless you know how to use the internet, like most young people do.
Under these new charter proposals, the BBC trust will be abolished, independent governing body. It does annoy me when they use the word independent, because you do wonder really if they're just trying to hide the fact that it's some sort of interest group that's going to be deciding who's on it. The independent governing body will be replaced by a new BBC board, back to the old system from 15 years ago, made up of 14 members, of which 9 will be appointed by the broadcaster itself. The chair will be selected through a government-led process, while the final 4 will be chosen as representatives for Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and England. In addition, the BBC will be held accountable by Ofcom, the UK's media watchdog for pretty much the rest of the media, and probably, I think, including us, actually. The regulator will review any proposed changes by the BBC to its core services, as well as complaints submitted by viewers. I suppose a cut to the chase with this, David. Do you think this is actually going to make any difference to the way the BBC's run? Because my impression is most of the appointments have got some sort of political slant to them, and they're, you know, you may be actually very good for the job, but they've already decided to a large extent who they want to run the corporation.
Oh, yes, there's people who serve their time in from whatever field that they come from. There'll be a couple of appointments from minorities just to show that there's the diversity there, but it's really about the BBC is well respected throughout the world, and these cuts and these changes undermines that level of respect. Whether that respect is true or worthy or not, the BBC usually gets to the reactions and the opinions of most of the people, and let alone the world leaders.
Rona Fairhead, she's St Catherine's College, Cambridge, president of the university's Law Society, Harvard Business School, Bain and Company, who've been connected, I've seen, with the Bilderberg conferences that I cover from time to time, Morgan Stanley, British Aerospace, Short Brothers, which is also Bombardier, UK Aerospace, ICI, Financial Times Group, and also, Martin, more importantly, maybe she was a non-executive director at HSBC Holdings and PepsiCo. At HSBC, she was on the risk committee, which had somehow managed to take the risk of dealing with these Mexican drug cartels, taking cash, massive amounts of cash, during the financial crisis to keep themselves going, and decided that the risk was worth it. And they did quite well, actually, because the fines were only were paltry compared to the amount of money they made.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not unhappy to see her jettisoned by Theresa May, but the question is she going to replace her?
Well, at the moment, that's a good question, because at the moment the vice chair is Roger Carr, who's also the chairman of BAE Systems, who are the biggest arms manufacturer in Britain.
No journalistic kind of skills there, really.
Well, no, he's quite good at making jet fighters, which they can then sell to the Saudis, which are then used to kill 95% to kill civilians in Yemen. That's one thing he's quite good at, making money at that, and I think it's something like £6 billion worth of arms sales there's been over the last year or so to Saudi Arabia. So that's something that he's a skill he really does bring to the BBC.
And of course it was Blair that stopped the Serious Fraud Office investigation into the Al Yamamar defence deal, which Mark Thatcher made a cool £12 million, and it was being referred to the SFO, and of course Blair stopped that from going ahead. If it went ahead, they'd all be in prison, wouldn't they?
They certainly would. Well, let's move on to another story. It's been another biggie this week. We had a big national story yesterday, didn't we, about the announcement of the go-ahead, finally, for the Hinkley Point Power Station. What are your first thoughts on that, David?
Well, it's going to affect Bristol as much as Somerset, because obviously the headquarters are based in Bristol, so there'll be a lot of influx of technicians and administrators. We've already got a very severe housing crisis in Bristol, so this new influx of professionals, new influx of families, was only going to push up the prices even more, and those people who are trying to get on the ladder or is just trying to get a decent place to live will be pushed out. They'll be squeezed between the professionals and the students. Those people in ordinary jobs or not employed won't be able to rent a place in Bristol.
What about wider energy policy? Do you think nuclear is the way to go?
Well, it's got a lifespan of 60 years, but of course we're hopefully going to be here more than 60 years.
But the good thing is it's got a death span of, I think it's 30,000 years, isn't it?
Half-life.
That's what they call it, is it?
So what happens after the 60 years? Do we just keep increasing the deadline by building more nuclear power stations? We've got to find another way. And there are other ways. There's tidal power. We've heard about the Cardiff Estuary
barrage
for years, and it's been dropped, and now there's one actually being used, a sea turbine being used in Scotland that's actually in production. We've got to think of other ways. We still haven't decided what to do, or haven't started to put the present amounts of stored nuclear waste, and yet we've now agreed to produce a hell of a lot more.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the tidal energy, because that's a massive story, I think, which was just not covered properly at all this week. Maybe with the Hinkley decision in the background, some of the news editors were thinking, well, people might realise that we don't need Hinkley. Apparently 50 of these what they call tidal platforms, which are anchored to the seabed and are just being installed for the first time. Nicola Sturgeon did a big kind of press thing up in Scotland on Monday about this. 50 of these things is the equivalent of one Hinkley Point power station. So really, you know, there's a lot of people saying that we don't really need the Hinkley power station. The world's first tidal stream power project is unveiled this week. Less than a decade ago, Timothy Cornelius, head of the tidal power venture Atlantis Resources, struggled to get investors and regulators to return his calls. Now, as he formally unveils the world's largest tidal stream project under construction, he can hardly fend them off. The level of interest has been almost unmanageable, Mr. Cornelius explained happily of the requests for visits and meetings. Now, Martin, this project is a little island off the north of Scotland, and the mainland has terrible currents. The fishermen and the people in their boats actually avoid it like the plague, but it's a perfect place to generate massive amounts of electricity.
Yeah, well, I don't think the economics of Hinkley Point add up, which is why, you know, the Economist and various people in the city of all Financial Times have all said it's a white elephant. It is a white elephant, and of course, if we go ahead with it, we will end up paying subsidies to the people running it well into the future, and it'll either go on to the bills.
It's going to be £20 on every single person in Britain's bills for the next 35 years.
Which, of course, then undermines the competitiveness of your exports and so on. So, I mean, when the initial nuclear power surge in Britain in the 50s and 60s and so on, we're still paying for that now. I've seen figures that suggest that 2p in the pound on income tax goes to look after nuclear waste. And there's an awful lot of waste in government expenditure, and it's not from single mums. Well, it's because of nuclear power.
That's interesting, because there's been, I think, looking at these news articles around this, it seems very, very little discussion about what's happening to the waste from Hinkley C.
Well, indeed, what happens when they wanted to privatise nuclear power in the 1980s, and the city was all raring to go, and then they looked at the books, and then they realised that they had to take control. You know, they'd have to be insured against the waste for well into the, you know, the private sector said we're not touching this, and the only way that nuclear power has ever succeeded is in countries like France and China, where politics is in command, where you've got a free market, it just doesn't run. And but you can see the vested interests in, you know, we've done a deal with the Chinese for example to be part of the Asian Investment Bank, which was George Osborne said he was one of the first to sign up to it, much to the disgust of the Americans. But of course, if you're going to do that, then you've got to, you know, it's quid pro quo is that they get to produce this nuclear power
station. Well, one of the facts to do with this, which I'd never seen anything written about or talked about before, is we're keeping rather quiet, was this whole side, David, that once this plant is built, once the contracts are signed, once it's nearly built, it looks as if then the next nuclear power station at Bradwell will be entirely Chinese owned and built. And what's happening is it's almost like a superpower moving in, like the Americans have done in many countries over the years, where you've got not the major infrastructure of the country is not actually owned and controlled by the Brits. It's either the Chinese or the Americans or somebody else.
Yes. The word or the name Bradwell is only now being aired. I listen to a fair bit of the news and read all the newspapers. It's only now, in the last two or three days, that, there's a second one that the Chinese want to finance and want to build. So it's not a one elephant. It's possibly a whole tribe of elephants, a whole group of elephants. But we've also got to remember that when you're talking about infrastructure, who makes the decisions? What's profitable, what's not profitable, and what's where things go? The Chinese have built a number of stadiums in the West Indies for cricket, and in Africa they're very predominant in building railway lines and roads. And whilst they are trying to influence and peddle some sort of kudos, it's also a matter of the governments in those countries having to agree to the terms, i.e. not African and West Indian workers, but Chinese workers actually being shipped out to do these constructions.
Also worth mentioning, Martin, isn't it, that the Germans have very, very clearly said, and I was really hoping that Laura Koonsberg or someone else on the BBC would include this in their report about this decision, that Germany has very clearly decided we're having no more of this nuclear, and they're prepared to pay the price as well for having no more nuclear. They think that the whole thing is a total disaster in terms of waste and also in terms of the actual cost to the consumers and reliability, all sorts of reasons why they don't want one. The other thing the Germans said, by the way, is these places are incredibly vulnerable to not just to a terrorist attack, but if you get involved in a war, another country is just simply going to plant a couple of bombs, send a couple of missiles, and your power station is actually a disaster area where you've got nuclear waste all over the place.
Well, the Austrians were actually using the EU regulations to say that there was unfair state aid involved in the Hinkley Point project. And, of course, we're leaving the EU now, so we can stick two fingers up to Austria and do what we like. We can waste our own money if we want. Billions. We've got billions to waste, haven't we? Now we've given up on austerity. Do you remember austerity?
I mean, isn't this more to do? Don't you think this is more to do with relationships with China than it is to be making sure that our bills, electricity bills, are secure and supplies for the future?
Well, the fundamental point is, as made by Amory Lovins and the Rocky Mountain Institute years ago, is that the technology of energy saving is much more straightforward. And what we should be doing, we should be double glazing every home in Britain at public expense. That's the sort of thing that needs to happen, and we should be reducing our use of resources, period. Whether climate change is real or not real, we're going to debate that in the second hour, but in any case, what we should be doing, and the technology is fairly straightforward, we know what to do, we just haven't got the will to carry it out.
Okay, let's look now at the Tory party and UKIP, and we hear today Diane James has been elected as the UKIP leader. I don't know if anyone's heard of her, have they, around the studio?
Not I.
She orders Theresa May to stop the fudge on Brexit after Nigel Farage urges his party to unite. None of the main people were expecting to take over were even allowed to stand as party leader in the UK Independence Party, which makes that almost as much of a mess as the Labour Party, the problems that have been happening there with the so-called coup. But also, more importantly, should we say, good time to quit. David Cameron's exit from the Commons comes 2 days before a damning report. He resigned before the report on Libya and ISIS was released. On Monday, the MP for Witney announced he would be standing down from his role, with immediate effect triggering a by-election in the Oxfordshire seat. But a report released by the Foreign Affairs Committee just 2 days later claimed the former Prime Minister was ultimately responsible for the failure of the controversial 2011 bombing campaign on Libya. Mr Cameron became MP for the seat, one of the safest Conservative seats in the country, in 2001, before stepping up as Tory leader in 2005. Many assumed his resignation was linked to the Remain campaigner's failure to secure enough votes. But today, just days after he announced he would be quitting his role, Cameron has been the subject of a damning report from his fellow MPs. Martin, what do you make of this report and the possible connections with David Cameron deciding he's had enough, he wants out of the Commons?
Well, if we come to the report, I think the report is pretty good. It basically points out that there was mission creep. You know, they didn't really, you know, we there was supposed to be a no-fly zone to prevent a supposed massacre in Benghazi by aircraft, although, as the Russians pointed out at the time, there was no evidence.
Look,
that Libya
can
was
I just
praise
this report? What it says in a nutshell is you didn't do any kind of thought or preparation about what was going to happen after you'd removed Gaddafi. Your only interest was getting rid of him.
Well, can I say this? I actually think that the whole exercise was planned in advance by NATO intelligence services. Southern Mistral 2011 was an exercise between the RAF and the French Air Force about an uprising in an unnamed country.
Yes, an exercise, Martin, not a real operation.
Tony, yeah, but the point is that the exercise was exactly the same as the actual war that then took place, and all of the aircraft for the war were ready in place in southern France, ready to play their part in the no-fly zone over Libya, because they'd actually done an exercise, Southern Mistral 2011, which was going to be creating a no-fly zone in an unnamed country where there has been an uprising and the no-fly zone has been called for by the UN. And then suddenly, glory be, exactly that scenario was then played out. And of course, the rebels inside Libya, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, have been working, and they're Al-Qaeda Libya, they've been working with British Special Forces since the 1970s. So the whole thing was orchestrated, just as the takedown of Assad was orchestrated. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, has been on television in France. He said, before 2011, before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials when I was at a party in London, and they said to me, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria.
Yeah, in Syria? Do you want Libya?
Yes, but of course, the Libyan overthrow of Gaddafi then led to all of the militants from Libya, including Abdul Hakim Belhaj, the head of Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. He then transferred to Syria to become a commander in the Free Syrian Army, and of course they took loads and loads of weaponry from Libya to Syria, including the sarin that was used, according to Seymour Hersh, the sarin that was used in the Ghouta chemical weapons attack by the al-Nusra Front on civilians in Ghouta in order to try and pull the British and the Americans
into
Syria.
Anyway, look, let's just get back to the main point, David, maybe if you can drag us back. What do you make of the timing of David Cameron saying he doesn't want to be an MP?
I'm afraid, Tony, I'm going to drag you further away, because this is something that's prevalent in Parliament, and people who leave Parliament, that's the point, leave Parliament. We've just heard from the hacker of General Colin Powell's emails that Jack Straw emailed Colin Powell and said, the one good thing about the Brexit vote, which we are likely to lose, is that it comes 2 days before the Chilcot report, and it can cover over that. So this idea that people just resign to spend more time with their families is actually hogwash. Or in David Cameron's case, he's such a family man, he loves to spend time with his children. They look to what's the bad PR and consider whether it's better to jump now or be pushed. And he and Jack Straw decided to jump, and hopefully the current media controversy would cover up.
A good day to bury bad news. That sort of
very much so. Very much so. 9/11 quote from a PR person.
While we're on 9/11, it's just been the anniversary. Emmerdale star Adam Thomas has faced a backlash with his controversial 9/11 terror attack tweet this week. The actor was tweeting during Tuesday's Truth, Lies and Conspiracies documentary on ITV, which was excellent, actually, for a change, for a documentary about 9/11. And it was focusing really on the plight of the families of the victims of 9/11 over in the States, trying to get a court case going against the Saudi hijackers, Martin. And this has been blocked effectively because the Saudis have threatened that they're going to pull nearly $1 trillion worth of their assets out of the United States, although that wasn't covered in the documentary.
Well, I don't know. What are we commenting on this Emmerdale guy's tweet, or are we talking about 9/11?
What he said was, I hope the truth comes out one day.
Well, that's a perfectly straightforward thing to say, isn't it? And in actual fact, 15 years later, the evidence of some kind of inside job there is overwhelming, frankly, just like the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, which the police in Italy have pointed the finger at the NATO intelligence services being behind that. Captain Fontana in 1969.
Let's just stick to 9/11, please.
Okay.
And David, what do you make? I mean, he's actually said a little bit more than that. He's saying the star suggested it might have been a big conspiracy while watching the documentary, I Hope the Truth Comes Out One Day.
It's all passed me by. I've been so gripped by the Archers storyline that I just haven't had time for anything else, any other soap star.
He's not actually said it on Emmerdale, but he's questioning what really happened on September 11th and if there's been some kind of a cover-up, who were the real perpetrators. I mean, it looks as if the Saudis were certainly involved, but the American government is saying, well, we can't prosecute the Saudis, otherwise they'll collapse the dollar. You know, this does seem to be a way of stopping anybody, and particularly the families would say this, getting to the truth.
Yes, very much so. And there's been stories about the only plane being allowed in internal airspace just after the towers went down on the Pentagon plane was a Saudi plane picking up members of the royal family and anybody connected to the royal family. And there's all sorts of rumours that are coming out, and of course we won't know until WikiLeaks, Snowden or whomever managed to get out those emails and
see hacks. The trouble is we've got all of these various wars around the world all based on that America was attacked on 9/11 and they've got to have this war on terrorists and all this kind of thing, and this is seems to be, these wars seem to be characterized with great long drawn out wars, occupations, and they don't really seem to actually achieve their object, as we've seen in places like Iraq, we've seen in Libya, and we've seen obviously in Afghanistan and most recently in Syria.
Well, we had Bush Senior saying that he was going to light the torch of democracy in Iraq, and he's lit a torch, but it's the whole of Iraq has gone up in it.
It's not all that democratic, no. All right, well, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions, and we did mention Jeremy Corbyn earlier on, but he seems to be using his questions now to ask the same sort of question, following him up again and again, which is a pity, because I like it when he brings up all sorts of different subjects rather than repeats the same sort of question again and again. And this week, it was all about grammar schools.
Mr. Speaker, of course I welcome anyone that's managed to get a job. I welcome those people that have managed to get jobs and keep themselves and their families together. The problem is that there are now almost a million of them on 0 hours contracts who do not know what they're going to be paid from one week to the other. And in order to help her with the expertise on the reform of secondary schools, could I quote to her Michael Wilshaw, the Chief Inspector of Schools, who said quite simply this: the notion that the poor stand to benefit from the return of grammar schools strikes me as quite palpable tosh and nonsense. Yeah. Isn't all this proof that the Conservative Party's Green Paper addresses none of the actual crises facing our school system? A real terms cut in schools' budget, 500,000 pupils in supersized classes, a crisis in teacher recruitment and retention, rising number of unqualified teachers in classrooms, vital teaching assistants losing their jobs. Isn't this the case of a government heading backwards to a failed segregation for the few and second-class schooling for the many? Can't we do better than this?
I have to say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that he has got some of his facts wrong. Plain and simple. We have more teachers in our schools today than in 2010. We have more teachers joining the profession than leaving it. We have fewer pupils in supersized classes than there have been previously. But I simply say this to the Right Honourable Gentleman. First of all, that he has opposed every measure that we have introduced to improve the quality of education in this country. He has opposed measures that increase parental choice, that increase the freedom for head teachers to run their schools. He's opposed the opportunity for people to set up the free schools. These are all changes that are leading to improvements in our education system, and we will build on those with our new policies. But I recognise for the Right Honourable Gentleman, this may very well be the last time that he has an opportunity to face me across this dispatch box. Certainly if his members of Parliament have anything to do with it. I accept he and I don't agree on everything. Well, actually, probably we don't agree on anything. But I must say to him that he has made his mark. Let's just think of some of the things that the Right Honourable Gentleman has introduced. He wants coal mines without mining them, submarines without sailing them, and he wants to be Labour leader without leading them. One thing we know, whoever is Labour leader after their leadership election, it will be the country that loses.
Well, I'm not sure she was quite answering the question there about grammar schools. David, what do you make of this debate about our schools? What Jeremy effectively saying there is, well, you can tweak what kind of school you've got, fine, but actually you're not addressing the fundamental problems, which are just simple lack of funding for our schools.
Yes. As an ex-grammar school boy, can I say that it's not just about funding, it's about the profession as well, teaching profession. One of the biggest complaints that teachers make is that things are always changing. It's never settled, whether it's grading in the exam system, whether it's the mark in the exam systems, and now we have, in Bristol, we have a chaotic system of grammar schools, private schools, whether they're called private or public, I don't know, comprehensive schools or whatever. There's just no system that you can say, well, look, there's a standard and this is what we want our children, our students to attain. It's a complete mismatch, and it's dependent on money. It's not dependent on intellect, dependent on whether you can afford tutors, crammers or whatever to get into a selective school. It's a mess, and we actually had the ridiculous situation, although it was his perfect right, for the Deputy Director of Education for Avon County Council sending his children to a private school. That's the ridiculous level we reached then, and I may still pertain now.
Seems strange, doesn't it, that a lot of people are making these decisions, they're not actually part of the state sector at all. The kids aren't.
Certainly, yeah, yeah.
Also, before we finish, must ask you about St Paul's Carnival, because a couple of years now, it's just simply not happened. Seems to be going through the doldrums. Now there's suggestions it might be a paid-for style event. What do you make of the way it's developed over the last few years?
What's been suggested? Assistant director. I always the bridesmaid, never the bride. What's come out of the Carnival Commission, which was paid for by the Alts Council, and there's been two or three meetings, is that there should be a new body to run Carnival. There's been two or three different models to look at. There is a meeting next Thursday at City Hall, also known as the Council House, where invitees are being gathered to discuss the report and the responses to the report, and there see how things go. The one thing that should be scotched is that the money has been ring-fenced, and so there can be a carnival. Whether it goes forward in 2017 or 2018 depends on which model is adopted. But as in all carnival, you must have the licenses, you must have the applications in, and as each month goes by, then it's harder to get the licences through in time.
I mean, do you think the police and the Arts Council were right to pull the funding and the City Council to say it's, you know, the people running the carnival are just not up to the job?
Circumstances change. The responsibility, the onus of running a carnival gets more and more in terms of insurance liability, and we've seen in the Nice massacre and in the French massacre.
So it's going to have to be a kind of paid-for event, you think, with security?
There may be a paid-for element, just like you have the Stokes Cross Festival, okay, where people have wristbands for certain areas.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guests, one of the Queen's representatives in the city, Deputy Lord Lieutenant of Bristol, David John. How was the Global Climate Panel chosen, and can we trust them? The present rate, how many years till the polar ice caps disappear completely? After the news at 6 o'clock.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.